Hello, gang. This podcast is brought to you by swag.com, SWAG. That's right. Those fun gifts that you like to send your customers and your employees. What's super cool about swag.com is that they're the first platform on the planet to have a turnkey software as a service solution for large companies. Their customers are Google, Facebook, Starbucks, Netflix, Amazon. You go kind of right down the list. And they're basically helping you manage your swag in a super efficient and a very elegant manner. What's particularly cool about swag.com is that they can manage your inventory for you. So you don't need to dig it out of your closet. They basically will store the inventory for you in one of their facilities, which are scattered around the country. And you just log into the portal. You can either make a new purchase or you can tell them to send some of your existing swag products to certain people. And you can send to one person or to 200. So it's a very cool platform that just kind of removes all of the messiness with picking, packing, and particularly shipping swag. I'll also mention that I'm an investor in the company because I like the product so much. There's no other solution out there that's so technology driven and just solves so many problems in the very archaic old school world of swag. So they've offered a discount for friends of the podcast, and the discount code is simply BOB10. That's BOB10, BOB10, and you'll get a 10% discount using that on their website, which is swag.com, SWAG.com. This podcast is also brought to you by All33's Backstrong Chair, which you've heard me talk about before. And apparently we are pushing a lot of product for them through the podcast. This is the best chair ever, and I do not say that lightly. The name comes from the fact that this is the first and only chair that allows for the movement of all 33 of the vertebrae in your spine while you sit. I have used fancy chairs over the years and not so fancy, and they all seem to disappoint in their own special way. And I'm sure you've experienced the same. Either the saddle feels good, but the arms don't, or the back doesn't move enough, or my legs start to lock up, and so on. I've been using the All 33 chair for just about a year, and it has completely removed my lower back pain and my general fatigue that I get when I sit too long. It's essentially slouch-proof. The saddle moves, which provides ergonomically correct support for the lower thoracic area and also promotes ideal posture. The saddle isn't fixed like most chairs, and instead it sort of moves in the same direction as your ball and hip joint. And of course, we all know that sitting is indeed the new smoking, and you need to sit correctly and need the right chair to do it for you. The folks at All33 have a $100 discount for friends of the podcast, and you can go to all33.com/discount/Bob to get that discount. Again, all33.com/discount/Bob. Hi, all. My guest today is Lara Abrash, CEO of Deloitte US Audit and Insurance Business. She's really a true leader, and I thoroughly enjoyed our conversation and time together. We discussed her personal story, her journey and path, particularly her quite impressive trajectory in terms of career, and how she's navigated it from a perspective of constantly evolving. And we hit on this theme of evolving throughout the conversation. Curiosity is also a big driver for her as well as it relates to evolving. And of course, is an important tenet for any serious leader who wants to climb to the corner office. We also hit on vulnerability and reflection and the importance and the fact that it's okay for a leader to show vulnerabilities with your teams and your employees. And as it relates to the notion of reflection, you know, one key facet of that is when we all reflect, we know that we're going to be beating ourselves up for something we should have said or done, or something we said or did that was really not handled in the appropriate way. And it's okay not to beat yourself up about this. The other thing within that theme that we covered is that, you know, it's crucial to take risks and to move beyond your threshold of comfort. And you only are going to be willing to do that if you're willing to be vulnerable with yourself and have the ability to reflect on your career. And along those lines, we talk about mentor-mentee. And what Lara does is she actually, at the top of her daily to-do list, she has two columns, one column for mentors and one column for advocates. And the mentors will tell you how it is, right? They're going to give you the good, the bad, and the ugly. The advocates are folks who are going to pound the table for you. And so she will make a note as to perhaps if she needs to reach out to either a mentor or an advocate for a particular thing that is on the task list for the day, which I thought was really interesting. She also discussed what we're seeing across talent and culture these days, from hybrid and the future of work to attracting and retaining employees. DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, is also near and dear to Lara's heart. And Deloitte, in fact, has an initiative on this front called MADE, Making Accounting Diverse and Equitable, which has an ethos rooted in providing training for Black and Latinx CPAs. Further, we hit on the topic of transformation, which of course is no stranger to any of us, because we're seeing it across every industry. And we discuss how Deloitte views this topic from the narrative, strategy, and execution fronts, and also to what she describes as the burning platform, which is meant to answer the question of why a company, in fact, needs to change, why a company needs to transform. Finally, we circle back to leadership and discuss Lara's personal leadership philosophy, qualities she looks for in employees, and traits that can be nurtured both in yourself and your teams. This is a really fun conversation. I was inspired, and I hope you are too. Enjoy.
The Bob Johnston Podcast.
Love to start on the personal front and just get a sense of your career path. I don't see any gray hair. I could be wrong. So you've kind of risen the ranks fast, and I'd be curious to hear what you attribute that to. Is it that your secret power is relationships and the ability to connect? Is it that you're just wickedly smart? What are your thoughts? I mean, I know that's a bit of a loaded question, but I'd love your thoughts.
Well, first I'll start. It all starts with a good hairdresser. So it's not all natural. So that's definitely a superpower. Listen, I've been with the firm at Deloitte for nearly 30 years. So a long time. But probably every opportunity I've had, I've been able to, have a bit of an ability to move quickly through it. The things that probably stand out to about me is I'm somebody who evolves. And I think that's been sort of a known attribute. My early days, probably, I talk a lot at Deloitte and outside about the concept of a brand. Like, what is your brand? Which, by the way, superpowers together could be your brand. But, I say it's the when the door closes, how do they talk about you? And the evolution of me, when I was younger, the brand was clearly somebody who got the things done that needed to get done. You know, you really couldn't give her something that, she couldn't, tackle. But there were some fundamental things that were there that are still here, an ability to connect with people, somebody who's compassionate, has a bit of a sense of humor. Hopefully we'll bring that out a little bit today. And that focus on evolving has always been sort of the thing that's there, and looking and seeking the next thing. And I've never focused on roles. I've always focused on, is there an experience that gives me energy? And it's something that I think is going to be hard to do, right? And I haven't done it before. Those things have been sort of a psychology for me over my career. And when I talk to our women, I talk about how sometimes women don't ask. And part of, advancement is actually putting yourself out there. One, that you're open to change, you're open to getting the feedback, you do make the change. when sometimes making the change is just not doing something, which is really hard to do. We could talk about that today. But, you know, my brand over time has really evolved to be someone who cares about our people. She's curious. Yes, she can get things done. She's bold. And every opportunity has been harder than the prior one. And you know, I try not to annoy people along the way.
That's really, really interesting and thoughtful. And I appreciate your candor and your honesty. When you think about the word evolve, which you mentioned a minute ago, what does that conjure up for you? If a leader is stuck and they need to figure out how to evolve, either grow or get a new position at a higher level, you know, what's some of the self-talk and what is the, you know, tips or tricks that you'd have to help a particular person or a particular leader evolve themselves more as it relates to the career?
Well, evolving first starts with a commitment that you really want to do what it takes. So let's start with that. You know, a lot of us will say we want it, and it's like a diet or something, but do you really want to put the work in? So it starts with just a real commitment to know evolving is going to require you to do something different. If you are committed, to me, it starts with a vulnerability of opening yourself up for feedback. You know, you talk about how you see yourself and how others see you. You can inform how you want to be seen, but that may not how you're being seen. So my first bit of advice after commit would be really opening yourself up to vulnerability and figuring out who are the people you want to get the input from. And that could vary from early days. I want people I trust that may not be part of helping me move forward, but they'll tell me the honest truth, to maybe I want to go to the CEO of a company and say, hey, I've been passed over the last several years for this opportunity. I just would love to hear what do I do well, and what are you not seeing from me or seeing that you don't like? And not try to be defensive about it. Even if in your mind you don't think you don't see it, someone else is. And then you can talk to a few data points. So I think it's the willingness to commit. It's the willingness to be vulnerable. And then really focusing on reflection and focusing on how do you internalize that feedback. And you don't want to spend your whole life beating yourself up either. So when you're in that reflection stage, it should be balancing the good things that you do, but at the same time, what are the things that maybe you need to do a little less of or you need to fix? I often talk about by the time you're 40 or 50, you're not going to change fundamentally who you are. But it's about an awareness. If there's something that who you are, maybe when it's a bad day, you do more of and it annoys people, it's about having the awareness. So it's that ability to reflect and then either think about change or think about not doing something. And it becomes a virtuous cycle, but you don't want to do this and come out of it feeling beaten. And that's an art. It's not a science. And, you know, you're the most important you, and you can only be the best you to others if you feel good about yourself. But if you really don't want to take the feedback, you're not going to evolve. And the last thing I'll say, I give this advice to all over on this, take a risk. You know, when people talk about evolution, part of it could just be, I'm just going to do something I've never done before. That's true evolution. I'm going to put myself in an unnatural place. And if you want a life on the carousel where the horse just goes up and down a little bit, or if you want the roller coaster, you know, pick which one you want. And if you're on the roller coaster, you're probably going to fail. And if you're failing, that means you're taking risks. That's a good thing. If you're not failing, that probably means you're not taking any risks.
Yeah. And, you know, it's what I sort of think about is the analogy of moving through thresholds of pain, you know, or discomfort with a career or even in your personal life. I mean, as you mentioned earlier, with your diet or with exercise or whatnot, it's when you're breaking through the thresholds is when you realize, oh, I can do this. And look, you know, the thresholds, they're going to get harder and harder and they will keep coming. But the more of them you break through, you know, it just becomes a process and it's embedded in your lifestyle and your way of thinking. And I love your comments around just reflection and vulnerability. I mean, I think, you know, in the corporate world, we need to talk more. We need to have like real conversations about, you know, reflection and vulnerability.
Totally. I mean, you know, I think for a lot of people, the last 5+ years has opened up the possibility, if that's sort of the way we can do things. When I was growing up in the business environment, it was CEOs of GE, like a Jack Welch, and he was buttoned up and he had a tie on, and, you know, he talked to his people like the Pope talking to a group of, you know, people that come into the church, as opposed to a relatability. I've been in your shoes, you know, how can we're, and I think the pandemic and all the societal issues we've dealt with, it created a commonality of, it didn't matter where you were in the world, you could get COVID. It didn't matter. You know, there was no vaccine. You could have COVID. Now, there were the haves and have nots. A lot of us had the ability to go work from home, and there were so many unfortunate people that had to be in the front line. But we were all dealing with the same fears at the same time. And that, I think, allowed for some real vulnerability to go on. And so I'm seeing it start to happen. It's really important that we don't make that go away and stick that in the back pocket.
Yeah, 100% agree on that. How much of the climb of a career, and we can jump into talent and culture, you know, how much of the climb of a career is proximity to power or proximity to people who have the ability to shape your future? And I guess I think about the saying that we're the average of the 5 folks we spend the most time with, which is sort of true. Although we usually spend the most time with, you know, with the, with our team, right? So I guess I'm thinking about the people that are not on the team, but maybe a mentor, maybe a colleague at another company or whatnot. You know, like, how much of this is just proximity to people who can have a, like, an effect on your career positively?
Oh, I mean, I'll give you my estimate. My guesstimate is it's 80% luck in who you know and 20% who you are. If you're in the right time at the right place, I mean, that's going to replace, you know, so many other things. I live in the New York, New Jersey area. It makes my life a lot easier because this is where we're headquartered. This is where many of our larger clients sit. And it allowed me to be around a lot of people. And that's why it's really important. And I do think this more virtual environment does play a bit to this. It puts the onus back on the individual to not just let that be the outcome. You know, to not just say, I'm just going to sit in those 5 people. You know, my focus over my career when I was elevating was I shouldn't admit that I'm a bit of a driver type of personality. So I always have a to-do list. And I tell people all the time that over time, there would be a list on a piece of paper, and then the very top of it would be names of people. And these were people that I either had a relationship with that I needed to get in touch with to evolve, or somebody that I thought I wanted to develop a relationship with. And I broke them into 2 categories, mentors and advocates. You know, the mentors being people who would, you know, back to that vulnerable environment, you know, I can complain to them. I can get an honest, you know, I was in that meeting, you know, nobody said anything after I said this. Am I overreacting? You know, you could have that type of conversation. Yeah. Advocates are people who can pound the table for you. They sit in the rooms where it matters. I'm a big Hamilton fan. There's a song, you know, the room where it happens. You know, if you're not in the room where it happens, the advocates are the people that are in that room where it happens. And I would intentionally make sure I was being more proactive, and not in a political way, because people could see right through that. Those relationships start with trust. You can't be the first meeting you show up and you want a promotion. The first meeting is starting to get to know someone and understanding. I call it, it takes 2 to tango. You can't be menteed if you're not open to being menteed. I really care about what you say and I'm going to react to it. And over time, those people change, but being intentional, as you said, to widen that net in a much more intentional way. So you're not just relying on proximity to do it. You're sort of taking a bit of the driver's seat to sort of create the outcome. So I've always tried to be much more intentional about that.
That's a great suggestion to have at the top of your list, is sort of, you know, a column of the mentors and another column of your advocates, because we all, I think, have them like in our head and we will ring them up occasionally, but to have it in writing in front of you, if there's a quick pressing question that you have, you know, you could shoot them a text, you could shoot them an email or something, and just have some quick feedback.
Yes, exactly.
And if they're a true mentor, they'll reply. If they're not, you won't hear from them for a week. But
right.
You know.
And, and it just, you know, over time, it's picking the best out of all these people. I mean, that's ultimately what you're trying to do. And then, of course, at some point, you'll be fortunate enough to be, you'll either be the advocate or a mentor for somebody else. And remember, it's important to pay it forward.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the elephant in the room in the business world at the moment. And you guys must see everything because you've got, you know, your client bases cross industry, cross function, et cetera. There's this whole quiet quitting at the moment, and there's this reflection that employees have been having over the past 24 months or so, thinking about their lives and their careers and so forth. What are you guys seeing in terms of hybrid with the future of work? And, like, you know, where are we in terms of retaining and attracting talent? And in terms of the great resignation, I mean, I haven't looked at stats for a little while here. So yeah, just love to see what you're hearing and seeing, what you're telling your clients, et cetera, and what you're seeing amongst your clients.
Yeah. So if you look across, I'll say our client base and even ourselves, all of our clients are impacted by, I'm just going to call, external trends of what their employees want and what they've ultimately allowed to create the best environment for their employees. I think there was some really well-intentioned actions by many employers over the last 3 years, whether it be about working from home, whether it be about not requiring people to come in, whether it be about, you know, a recognition of the societal issues that were going on and really creating, quite honestly, an environment that looked very different from my 30 years of doing what I do. And unfortunately, it's hard to put the genie back in the bottle. So we now have, people who have only worked in and from their homes, people that have, I'll just say, a more established networks, maybe they have children, they don't need to come in. They've got the network, they're working from home. So there's not a motivation to come in. They don't see the value. And the work, you know, I would say the employers probably haven't done a great job of really emphasizing what's really good about working from home and how you advance, how you develop, and what's really good about when you come in and how you advance and how you develop. And so over this time, you are starting to see and have seen, I'm going to use the words, the employee workforce taking the driver's wheel. You know, it's like anything in life. It's an economic outcome. You know, there's a shortage in supply, and then then it becomes more expensive. So comp costs went up over this period of time. Quite honestly, people were leaving without having jobs. Yeah. And that, in my life of growing up, someone wouldn't do that, but that was sort of the belief people had. And this quiet quitting is a continuation of the workforce feeling like they can control the outcome. When a company tells their workforce, you have to come in, and there's an uproar, it shows you that there's that control. You know, as we see the path forward, or as I see the path forward, I am a big proponent of hybrid. I actually think I'm doing this call with you today from my home. My son went to college for his first time on Monday. My daughter started high school yesterday. I was able to do the things I wanted to do and can make time for it by being able to adjust my schedule to do this. Next week, I'll be at a meeting with all of our new partners, celebrating with them in Florida. That's the type of thing you don't want to do over Zoom. You want to be together. You want human interaction. It's what we crave. So I'm a believer in focusing on those really high impact moments and making the experience of both sides work really, really well. But we have a period of learning to go through. So if anybody comes on your show or says, I've got it figured out, I would doubt them. I think this, you know, whether you think you should be in more or less all the time, none of the time, I think we're going to learn. But I think if we can get hybrid right, we can give back to society and families and people's personal lives something maybe they haven't done and make their experience better, but then get them in for the things that are super special. And that's where culture really will come to life.
So it's interesting, and I think I tend to concur that if any company or CEO says that they've figured it out, they probably haven't. I mean, because this is evolving and it will continue. How does a company sort of maintain culture during these times when, say, 3 days a week you may not have the folks there physically? Are there certain tricks, tactics, tips that you advise your peers on this front?
Yeah. Well, I would think when I think about culture, it's more of what you do than what you say. So how does the talent experience get felt by your professionals And is it consistent with what you say? So first, I would say culture is the belief system, the value system of an organization, and making it clear who you stand for. And that doesn't matter whether someone's at home or whether they're in the office. But yeah. Then being really intentional about the experience someone has when they're in one of the two places. So when they're in, it actually are things that are moments that matter, that are, they're high impact, you're committing to them, that I respect your personal time. I respect the fact that you're going to be more productive when you're in doing these types of things. And when you're home, not just ignoring it, which I do think during the pandemic, when everybody was working from home, we were just doing the best we can. If we're going to have a thriving hybrid environment, that means you're going to then create a great home experience. So committing to your workforce, how you're going to do that, how are you going to make sure they're not working different sets of hours? Now, all of a sudden, people are sort of saying, well, you're home anyway, you could just, you know, you could just do this. Or do you have the right equipment and assets for you to be successful? We started at the very onset giving out an asset reimbursement so someone can get a monitor or a certain chair, making an environment that they feel the same experience we're in. So for me, it's overarching things that you talk about and you see, and then making sure both sets of experiences live up to the talent experience you want to deliver. And that's culture being compounded into your people's heads every day.
Have you noticed that there's any, this isn't the right word, but any messiness in terms of quality of work because of folks working remotely? Or maybe the opposite. Maybe you have noticed that, in fact, you know, there's more efficiency and, you know, the effectiveness is going up.
I would say early on, this is a broad statement, you know, from what I've seen and what in talking to clients, early on, the efficiency and productivity and quality of work was better than when people were coming in every day. Now, it could be that people were afraid for their jobs because they didn't know what the pandemic would do relative to how employers would react. It could be, well, working is a lot better than putting on a news station and just hearing about a death toll. I'm just going to go in and just do more. But almost every client I talked to in those early days would say they were getting things done that they couldn't imagine they could have done. And that, you know, there was no quote unquote distractions. As we've evolved, I would say that productivity and equality has declined, and not to a point that it's not workable, but people are tired. I think there's a general fatigue in society. That's a lot for people to deal with, right? We're not machines, we're people. So I would say I'm seeing a bit of productivity getting a little bit worse, quality getting a little bit worse. And this quiet quitting is real. I mean, some of these stories about people looking for jobs, why they're working from home, these are real stories. They're not happening 100% of the time. Some people still want to do their job and they enjoy it. Purpose matters. But it is worse than it probably was at the very onset, but not to a point that it would suggest it's not going to work long term.
Right, right. That's interesting. And I think about the webinars we've hosted over the past 24 months. And of course, we used to do a lot of dinners in a bunch of different cities, and then we moved everything to virtual. And the conversations we've had with these executives, who are mostly from, you know, let's call it Fortune 1000 companies, is exactly that, what you just mentioned. There was a level of efficiency earlier on because I think that people were just happy to work again from the momentary lull or lapse. But now over the past 3 to 6 months, it seems to be where there's this trend of, you know, of exhaustion. We aren't robots, you know, we're humans, and business is personal. Sometimes it's emotional. And so, you know, how do we get the productivity we need from folks to serve our clients in the proper manner and really strike the right balance? That can be tricky when you have quiet quitting happening. And I don't know what the answer is. We'll probably be observing and playing this out in the next 6 to 12 months or so, and would love to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, and I'm sure your members can relate to this. If I look back over my lifetime, you know, you may have had an economic event, you may have had an interest rate issue, you may have had a recession, you may have had inflation, you may have had a cyber threat, you may have had a disruption from a competitor. You know, the list goes on and on. Those things are all happening at the same time now for many, many of our clients. they're dealing with significant macroeconomic trends. They're dealing with disruption. They're dealing with the need to digitize and move fast. It's exhausting. And now they're dealing with a workforce that wants to really, I don't want to use the word cater to, but it takes different effort when you really have to engage and listen with your workforce and really be that vulnerable leader we talked about early. It's exhausting because you go home and it's very different than solving. And I'm not saying these things are easy in the days that we dealt with it, but this group of leaders right now, this generation is dealing with complexities, again, without playbooks. There was no playbook for entering a pandemic or emerging from a pandemic, yet they've had to do it. There's no playbook for how do you address a workforce with one societal geopolitical issue after another. We have war going on. And that's impacting us. So that it's a conflux of it all coming together, and it's exhausting.
Yeah. Well, we have the right leaders who are at the helm of a lot of the organizations out there, like yourself. And I do think that they're going to build the roadmap. You know, they're building it now and they're figuring it out. And then probably we will arrive at a new set of sort of rules and standards and practices that I think will hopefully have a little bit of parity with the employers and, you know, the employees. And again, they aren't robots, they're humans. So, yeah. Let's switch for a second to the topic of DEI. And then I'd love to chat a little bit about transformation, since I know that you guys have been going through a ton of transformation over there the past kind of 36 months or so. And then I'd love to circle back to kind of leadership style, because I love to talk about that as a general theme. So DEI, what are you advising your clients on that front? And then as a company, where are you guys at in terms of your MADE initiative and, the importance, we talked about this earlier, but just the importance of creating, you know, a culture that's inclusive and meaningful.
Well, I'll talk about them both at the same time. You know, for your listeners, our MADE commitment is a program that we developed. It's called Making Accounting Diverse and Equitable. It's essentially focused on creating more diverse and very specifically Black and Latinx certified public accountants in the world. I'll say if I reflect back to, for me, a really humbling situation coming out of George Floyd and total transparency and vulnerability for all of you. I considered myself, we talked about all the great things I thought I did rising from being a staff auditor at Deloitte to being the CEO of this great business and all the ways I got there. And I felt pretty good about diversity, equity, inclusion. I thought, you could see me as the CEO of, and nobody like fell out of their chair when I got it. On paper, numbers seemed like they were pretty good. And I remember after George Floyd, watching the news one day after another and I honestly having sleepless nights and not really being able to know, like, why is this bothering me? I'm certain, and I'll say this again in the most humbling way, that I probably had seen events like that before as I walked through an airport and I kept walking. But what was it about this event that was bothering me? And I ended up calling some of our Black partners who I was friends with, and I sat with them on a Friday afternoon, and I just listened. And there was tears on the call, and I heard things that honestly made me disappointed in myself. And I said, I'm going to take this moment to really get behind this topic in a much more meaningful way. So first, like the comment we made earlier, about your own evolution, diversity, equity, inclusion is a tireless effort and requires commitment. So advice to the people that are listening, this is not for the weak-hearted. If you're going to do it, this is really put it all in or don't. And I would say one of the first lessons we really focused on was the data. The data tells you a lot of information, and we started disaggregating our data. We used to group data as minorities or underrepresented minorities, and it could mask information. And as we really pulled it back, we started realizing that maybe at a very high level, the data was telling you that you had the right numbers of people, that turnover wasn't so poor. But when we really pulled back and we looked at our Black and Latinx specifically cohorts, we were not doing a great job bringing in reasonable numbers, and the turnover was disproportionately higher than the turnover of our I'll say non-diverse workforce. And so we started again going into the root cause, and what we found was that in the area of accounting, there are only 1,200 or so students each year who come out of school that are Black that actually are eligible to take the CPA exam. And that is woefully not enough. I mean, there's less than 3% of CPAs are Black. It's like 2%. And there's not this creation of a pipeline to change that. And it doesn't represent that size of population broadly. So we developed MADE. It was a $75 million commitment to really figure out, well, what do we do? And it was about going into society, into communities, and creating an awareness and excitement about what it meant to be a CPA, what the job would be like, the financial security, because you can't be something you don't know what it is. And we found in a lot of urban environments, there was not an understanding. We're investing in colleges. We're giving out scholarships for the fifth year. For those on this call that are CPAs, they understand it. It's a five-year commitment to do it. So it's a financial burden, both that you have to pay for an extra year of college, mm-hmm. and it's a year that you're not working. So you essentially double that cost. And that's a big nut to carry over a lifetime. And then we're helping students pass the CPA exam. So we're really focused on it. So as I think about the topic more broadly, it's commit, set the tone at the top, really focus on the data, and then spend the time to customize the root causes of what you're trying to look for. There is likely different reasons that you don't have the right diversity of people across different cohorts. It could be the pipeline. It could be the talent experience and culture you're providing. Each one is going to be really different. We call them speed bumps. Try to understand the speed bumps and create ways to address them. The big pole in the tent, though, is the topic of inclusion. You know, when we would go out and talk to clients about their environment, the client would declare they had this great environment. It was this great inclusive environment. Well, if everybody looks like you, of course it's going to be inclusive because everybody's going to feel great. And so this idea that the moment you're not there, you're the CEO, the CFO, the CIO of an organization, and you could say all these things, you could invest in hiring, you could invest in having a DI office, you could do all these things. The moment you're not there and one of your employees is in a project room at a client site and they're not feeling included and quite frankly feeling excluded, that's when the whole thing falls apart. So the last piece of this is really investing in creating an environment where every person who comes in can be their authentic selves. That's the hardest part, and that's the part we're working on. And this is going to take collectively all of these organizations years to do. And that's what I mean by commitment. It's not something that comes and goes with, you know, good years and bad years. So a lot there. I could talk a lot more about it. Super passionate.
It's a big, big theme. How do you solve for, you did just on the back end of this conversation, how do you solve for if an employee has a bad experience at a client site? I mean, how do you talk to the client about that experience? And I think this would be interesting. Whatever word tracks that you are using would be great to share, I think.
Yeah. So it is about talking about your people as your most precious asset. And it's about talking to a client. You have your workforce. You have your machine A. That's your most precious asset. Our people are our most precious asset. And this is how they should be spoken to. And I've often said walking away from a client and not taking revenue, but to send a message is the strongest thing we could do to support our people.
Yeah. How are you, what are the KPIs or the metrics you're using to be able to track your MADE initiative? And I think, again, that this would be helpful for folks, you know, who may be at the beginning of the process.
So in our own workforce, we clearly are looking at hiring. We're looking at retention. We're looking at advancement, whether the promotion rates. Those are sort of, I'll say, the lagging indicators of things that we want to see. Mm-hmm. I'm a big proponent of leading indicators. Some of them are going to be sentiment. And some of them are going to be a quantitative indicator. Quantitatively, it's going to be things like how often are we doing a top talent review for our people? how often are we evaluating the coaching assignments for our diverse professionals, the things that we think are going to create the better outcomes. I call those the leading indicators. And the case of MADE, it's we have a program where for 3 months, we allow people to work and get paid, and their only job is to pass the CPA exam. So as a leading indicator, we're looking to see how many of those individuals are in fact passing an exam. Because if they pass that exam early, it's going to build the confidence to actually be here for the longer term. And then sentiment is a big leading indicator for us. And it gets back to inclusion. How do our people see us evolving? One, the tone at the top, but then how do they feel this every day? And over time, are we starting to see people feeling like this is a place that it could be their authentic self? So when I think about KPIs and tracking, it's the back end, which are going to be, everybody on the call is going to know them. They're the more obvious things, the things that tell you, am I getting it right? To me, it's the art of the inputs, the leading indicators, and making sure they tell you, are you heading in the right direction? Because this could take us 10 plus years.
Right, right. It's a commitment. Absolutely.
So let's switch gears a little bit over to the topic of transformation. And I guess, you know, this is obviously a buzzword nowadays on the tip of the tongue of most executive CEOs and boards. When I think of transformation, I guess you've got digital transformation, people transformation. And to me, if I were to line it up, it's essentially first you have to have your story and your narrative down. Then you can figure out strategy. Then you can look at execution. And then maybe fourth is, hey, on the execution piece, what technologies might we be able to leverage? So I guess for you as a company over the past 36 months or so, what is, you know, have you tweaked or changed your story or your narrative? And what are the levers you're pulling on the strategy and the execution fronts?
It's probably yes, yes, and yes. And I will start with is maybe one moment before that is the burning platform. What is it that is causing you to think you need to change? And burning platform is really important because a big part of transformation is aligning commitment of those you're asking to change what they do every day. And you need to be really clear about the why. Our transformation started probably 5+ years ago. I actually led our transformation. And the burning platform was we had over a decade created, I'll say, significant inefficiencies in what we were doing to create a high quality output. We were allowing every partner in our firm to essentially do what they thought they needed to do. And we had inefficiencies. We were under penetrating and leveraging technology. We were creating a distributed workforce that was, again, inefficient. And we weren't giving clients value. We spent all this effort just to get the product done, and it wasn't creating a really good outcome for them other than they, you know, we did the work we were set up to do, but there was no end. And so when we set out to do this, our burning platform was quality is incredibly important to what we do. We're regulated. It's who we are. It's our purpose. So we needed to make sure that was going to get better, at least doing this. We needed to be more profitable. We thought if we did this right, we'd be differentiated, which we in fact ended up seeing ourselves become. And then my own passion was I wanted the talent experience to evolve. I used to joke with our partners, our people can buy a pair of shoes and reserve a table at a restaurant on their phone right now. And when they come in, we're giving them, you know, Excel and Word, and we're not giving them the technology that they see. So for me, it was a multifaceted burning platform. And when we talk about this with clients, to your point, we are thinking about transformation and really boiling it down. Are you transforming the front office, which is how do you face off with your customers? Are you all of a sudden becoming an online retailer versus a in-store retailer? Like that's a type of transformation. And then on the back end, it creates, needs to evolve the back office. Like, do you need a different finance organization or a different HR organization? So being really clear, the burning platform, and then are you changing your offerings? Are you just changing, you know, someone is on this call, maybe from the CFO's group who just wants to do it bigger, quicker, faster. So being really clear what it is. And I would say the areas that we focus on is we call it work, workforce, and workplace. That's the I'll just say, if you had a consultant on, that those would be the words they'd use. So transforming the work is the work itself. We focused on standardization. So we didn't have every team doing it their own way. So we went in and just like you'd expect a auto manufacturer to do, we standardized the approach. We embedded technology into that approach, whether it be workflow, automation, or things like analytics. It became a part of the offering. And then that by its nature evolved the types of people you needed and what they were doing. And that's the hardest part of transformation is people get scared when you start talking about technology and automation, because what you hear as an employee is you're taking my job away. And so it creates this inertia not to, back to the quiet quitting. It's another inertia, which is we can't do this. This won't work. We're saying we'll do it and then not doing it. It's really back to that burning platform. You have to talk about the what's in it for me. So when you're going to ask people to change what they're doing, you have to put it in language around what's in it for me. And yeah. We spent a lot of time with our employees and our partners talking about how their lives would be better. And it wouldn't be about having less. Matter of fact, our workforce has actually grown since we did this, but it's grown because we've grown, as opposed to this vision of smaller and less of us. So those are a couple data points of things that we've been doing, but very focused on technology, cloud, data, and analytics.
Yeah. You know, it makes me think about the saying, and this is, you know, like another beauty, is that the client's a client, but the employees are each other's clients too, and they have to serve each other. And so I think if there's a technology that you can use just to make that more streamlined, you know, and more efficient, you know, then great. Maybe it's a Slack, maybe it's whatever messaging platform you're using out there. But yeah, you know, the employees, they're each other's clients.
Yes. Yeah. And you want that experience to feel like they didn't go back to the Flintstones when they walked inside your organization.
Right. So I'm conscious of the clock, of course. And I'm wondering if we can circle back to chat a little bit about leadership, because I love the beginning of the conversation here, and I'd love to drill down a bit. Have you developed over the years a leadership philosophy or a code or a set of rules that you seem to work for you, that seem to work for you within that business? And might they be relatable and transferable to various other industries?
Well, I talk about three words that definitely have worked for me and I think are positioned for leaders facing the next 5 to 10 to 15 years when I think about what's likely going to continue to come at us. And it's around vulnerability, empathy, and compassion. And there's some overlap there, but the idea that as a leader, you could be vulnerable about yourself and your own evolution and what you need to do, that you could actually be vulnerable about how you're feeling. We don't have to act again like robots, back to that point earlier. We can have a bad day too. And we can talk about that. We can find places to vent. My mom's biggest words of advice for me, and she's had a ton, is you can't be there for others if you're not there for yourself first. And so as a leader, being vulnerable about yourself and what you need is important. But it's equally important that you're vulnerable with those around you, you know, to a point. You don't want to be a sopping mess, but be open about the things that are going on in your life, your hopes, your fears, with some level of confidence, creates a level of relatability that is really important. If you're going to ask someone to run through a wall, they have to trust you and they have to feel some sort of connection to you. So I think in an environment with people working in different places, they're not necessarily all in the same room anymore, with, you know, pandemics, war, societal things going on, a lot of fears, you know, vulnerability does create, you know, a relatability. You know, empathy is the ability to listen and relate. And, you know, coming into a role as a leader with others and not knowing what's top of mind to that room, you're just going to be talking into the distance. And you're going to talk over them. And if you want to really create a culture of trust, a culture of inspiration, a culture of we're going to do this together, to me, it starts with the ability to be empathetic. And you have to listen to people and you have to play back to them what you know is going on and not just sugarcoat it. I know today is really hard. It's your first day back in the office, you know, after the pandemic or whatever those things are. And that creates, at least, or has created for me, a really successful environment. And then compassion back to the robots piece. I mean, we all can make a decision about how we want to approach the workforce. We can say we're unhappy that they're quitting in droves, that they're doing quiet quitting. But ultimately, you know, whether they're here or not, when they're here, you want them to thrive. So I don't look at turnover as being my metric of, you know, am I doing a good job or is this a great place? If they're thriving, that's the most important metric. And I'm a big believer that if you're compassionate with your people, again, to an extent, you can't fix everybody's problems, but you're, you know, when someone loses a family member, I reach out to them. If I'm, you know, I'm trying to show that I care, we care, that's the organization we are. So those are the three things I would say have become words I use that see, I think are going to transcend all of us into the future.
What qualities are you looking for in your leadership team?
So for sure, those three things are important to me. But probably some of the other things I look for is curiosity is a really important attribute to me. Somebody who's willing to challenge the status quo. They just want to learn about something. It doesn't necessarily mean we do everything we learn about. So curiosity is a really important one. That inclusive topic we talked about goes beyond just diversity. It's diversity of thought. So I want leaders around the table to challenge each other, but also to make sure we bring in the diverse voices. So to go around and actually make sure everybody said something. I mean, I pride myself on knowing when someone's making a face on a Zoom, they're not happy. Get them to open up and share that. So that I want us to have an environment where we expect debate, we want and seek debate, and then we seek creating an inclusive and accepted outcome. That's also a really important philosophy for me. And then I guess this is the last thing. It's probably going to sound really corny to everybody on, but like I'm a big believer of work hard, play hard. And what I mean by that is I want our people to have fun. I want my team to have fun. I want them to come in and feel like we're doing really important things, but that we're also enjoying each other's company. We spend a lot of time in our jobs. I used to say we spend a lot of time at work. I guess that definition's changed, but we spend a lot of time working. And you're in the, you know, the bunker with people that are on your team. And you want to make sure that you can create an environment where they actually really like each other and they're having fun. It doesn't mean, again, every day they agree with each other, but create that environment. So fun to me, within, again, everything within boundaries, fun in today's day and age is important.
100% agree. And I think there are some fun little things, you know, that you can do in the virtual world to, you know, sort of create the bonding there.
Yes.
So I guess the final question is, and we spoke a bit about this in the beginning of the conversation, is mentors, mentees. What do you look for in a mentor? And I know that we're not interviewing mentors per se. We're very fortunate to have folks who are willing to spend their time with us. But to the extent that it's important for a leader to find their holes in their leadership practice, what do you look for and what do you advise your peers to look for when you're hunting for mentors?
I find it, you know, this is a saying, it's lonely at the top. So when you're looking for a mentor, you really do need to look for somebody who you're setting the environment that you're open to the brutal, honest truth. So I often will say, one, I'm picking people that I have a confidence or are not going to sugarcoat it. And then I will even go into the conversation saying, this is a safe spot. I just need to know what you're hearing, what you're seeing, because I may not be seeing it myself. So I would start with finding somebody that you have ultimate trust is going to tell you the things that, not just the things you want to hear, but the things that you need to hear. And if you're going to ask for their advice, you have to also demonstrate that you're willing to take it. So this idea that mentorship is a two-way street, you know, you're not going to ask and just dismiss it. So somebody who you know is going to give you sound advice is important. And then you have to take it every time, but you got to start taking some of it. Otherwise, they're going to say, why'd you even bother, you know, asking? And then I think about finding people that think differently than me and have a different style than me. You know, I am, confident. I am bold. I'm very, I'll say, easy to talk to. But that may not be the group of people that I interact with every day. So having somebody who has different attributes who say, you know, when you're in a meeting and you're asking people what if they have something to add, the way it came across some of the people that are introverts are probably were not going to pick up on that and say something. And this is how I would have felt if I were in the room, but really push you because you may not be able to see it. So someone's stylistically different from you and maybe experience go young and go old. I'll have people experience me and much more experience than me. And I would say I do that. I do it formally and informally. Formally at the firm, we have groups of seniors and managers that we gather to give us input. But then even individually in a trusted way, I'll reach out to those individuals to get their views.
That's great advice, actually. Yeah. It's when I think of the mentors that I work with at the moment, I don't think any of them are younger. And the fact is, if you're not, you know, if you're not gathering knowledge from folks who are probably a little more nimble and their mind is working a little, you know, a little bit more smoothly and faster, you know, than I am at middle age, then, you know, you're missing out.
And that's your workforce. Like, right. I'm not working with a bunch of 50-year-olds. Your workforce is going to be 25 and 30. And so yeah. I bounce ideas off of them. And I often would say, how would this play if I said this, or is this how the group is feeling? It's important.
Well, this was a lot of fun, and I know we're kind of wrapping up here. Is there anything else on the leadership front or the DEI front that you'd like to cover? Anything at all that you'd like to share with the audience?
Well, I talked about a lot of these topics today about having commitment, right? I said, you know, about your own evolution. I talked about it with diversity. I talked about it with transformation. There is an underlying commitment to being a leader. It's not unnoticed to me how hard it is. All of us that are on this call have made that commitment inherently by being here. So the takeaway for me is, I often talk to our partners and our people about having a growth mindset. And I would close out that if we all have a growth mindset and really widen that definition of what we mean by growth, growth could be personal growth. Growth could be growth and a commitment to purpose. And in this case, it could be diversity, equity, inclusion. Growth could, of course, be to the work you do and how you do it. And just trying to keep a growth mindset, that's a healthy thing. And it all comes under those other topics we talked about around curiosity and taking risks. If you're willing to do all those things, you're going to grow personally and you're going to build the next generation of leaders. Thank you. It was awesome. It was a really good time.
It was great. Okay. Really, really appreciate it, Larry.